I have some announcements to make this morning. This afternoon is open house, and this afternoon at 1:30 in the auditorium, Paul Thomas, our librarian, is going to give some detailed description of the terrific love affair she has developed with the City of London. She is so delighted with that community that she's threatening to go back at the slightest provocation. And with all its museums, libraries, and wonderful old buildings, churches, and so forth, London is certainly a picturesque and historically significant metropolis. So she's going to also add to this a number of pictures and slides which she took herself. So you're all invited to be in the auditorium at 1:30 to see the story and hear about the things that are to be seen in London. I can vouch for the fact that these things are very real and of interest to most people. Also, I'd like to announce that we have on Sunday morning program next week, Daniel Bushnell is the speaker. He will talk on the subject of what is the spiritual life. He is the leader of a choir group of 35 singers who will also be present on the stage at this time. Several numbers will be given before and during the talk itself, which will be interwoven with the music that they will perform. We hope that many of you will be able to attend this program, which should be very interesting. And don't forget that next Sunday, you're on daylight savings time. Now we can proceed with the business of the morning. There was an old Greek philosopher. His name was Aristippus, and he had the reputation of loving to enjoy life. And one day he went on a long trip, and because he was traveling, he took his money box with him. And while he was on the ship, he overheard the crew discussing the probability of stealing the money and tossing him overboard somewhere during the trip. Well, this kind of annoyed Aristippus. So the next morning when the sun came up, the crew saw him sitting on the bowsprit of the boat, way out in front, and he had his money box with him, and he was picking out the coins one by one and dropping them into the ocean. And they said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I think it is better that the gold shall perish for Aristippus than that Aristippus shall perish for the gold." This, I think, is a little more pertinent than you may first imagine, dealing with the problems of today. Another ancient symbol that is very interesting and productive of thought is the old Egyptian symbol of a serpent with its tail in its mouth. This serpent, of course, is the symbol of life, light, wisdom, strength, and all these things. But when the tail is in its mouth, the Egyptians tell us the snake was eating itself. It was living on its own body. And finally, it would reach the point where there was nothing left but its head and nothing else left to eat. This also is very pertinent to the moment, with problems that are existing around us every day. Now, this problemed world in which we live is responsible for a great many problems. And these problems are, many of them, well within the boundaries of crime. We are creating a cultural misunderstanding. We are losing sight of the essential values of life. And in so doing, we are endangering the survival of our way of life. In order to enjoy the securities that are ours by intelligent effort, we must protect ourselves against the abuse of those values without which civilization must collapse. Today we have a number of serious difficulties on our hands, one of the most pressing being the problem of narcotics. This particular issue has a great many different aspects, and I want to try to cover a few of them this morning. The use of narcotics goes back a very long way into antiquity. But for the most part, in ancient times, it was associated with religion. Also, in those ancient times, which are perpetuated in some of the American Indian communities of today, where certain narcotic drugs are used in religious rituals, there seems to have been very, very little problem. There is no indication that these usages in antiquity resulted in a popular addiction which damaged or endangered the whole structure of civilization. One of the reasons was that the person or the persons using these drugs must realize that he is part of the chemistry of the consequences. In other words, if, as in primitive times, an individual had very few ulterior motives, was largely given to a strong religious conviction, and was doing his best to be a proper citizen, or was under a discipline of social laws sufficient to keep him straight, under those conditions, there were very few dangerous hallucinations. The person himself was not confused in his normal state. Therefore, confusion did not become aggravated by the use of drugs. In the oracles and so forth, only those who were of pure mind and pure heart were permitted to give oracles induced by volcanic fumes or any other medium. If an individual was corrupt, any use of that would stimulate the development of attitudes was considered to be dangerous and was prohibited. So what we are suffering from, in part at least, is the subconscious being released and bearing into the objective a mass of confusion, discord, dissatisfaction, disillusionment, and frustration. The moment this gate is open, Pandora's box has the lid lifted, and out of it comes every kind of tension, stress, and misuse which has been chemically or alchemically caused within the person himself. If he is dissatisfied, aggravated, disillusioned, disappointed, all of these things become consciously projected upon his outward personal conduct. He becomes the personification of the grudges which he has developed. He becomes the personification of the social usages which he objects to. And he is also seeking a kind of negative deliverance from the contemplation of his own problems. Wherever we find this addiction developing, we find disillusioned persons. Now, why are they disillusioned? Well, many people believe that there are ways of being happy, and when these ways fail, this is a serious disillusionment. Among the disillusionments of today is that of wealth. The individual determined by the psychology of his environment to struggle for the accumulation of a large fortune, then suddenly finds himself in a condition in which this is not helping him, but is providing him with the funds to get into further trouble. He is not able to use the things which he has. There was a farmer in Rome who dug up a pot of gold, and he didn't know what to do with it, so he wrote a note to Caesar. And he said, "Caesar, I've found a pot of gold. What shall I do with it?" Caesar wrote back two words, "Use it." The man wrote back again to Caesar and said, "I don't know how to use it." Then this time Caesar wrote back three words, "Then abuse it." And this is exactly what happens in sober fact. When we don't know how to use what we have, we begin to use it mistakenly, trying desperately out of wealth to achieve happiness, to achieve a personal sense of security. Now, in order to have a sense of security and purpose, we have to be doing something worthwhile. We must have ideals. We must have convictions. We must have projects that are meaningful to society. Where there is no project beyond the satisfaction of personal attitudes, nearly anything that we have will be abused. And we will suffer from the negative mistake that assumes that the more we have, the happier we will be. The truth is, the more we have, the more we will abuse what we have unless we know how to use it rightly. Actually, therefore, a large part of our narcotic problem is a byproduct of the social situation in which we find ourselves today. There is no doubt in the world that it is also a case, again, of the snake devouring its tail, because society is producing antisocial forces which are hard at work to use society to destroy itself. This type of problem is well represented in the peddler of cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. These people are perfectly willing to sacrifice the survival of a way of life in order to make a few fast dollars. Wealth has become, again, a very important factor in our way of life. And as long as wealth is the major consideration in personal conduct, we're going to be in exactly the condition we're in now, and probably it will get worse. The idea that the reward for effort is to be paid in terms of money, or in terms of public acclaim, or in terms of control of other persons' lives, as long as these are our motives, we're in trouble. These are a kind of madness in themselves, and the good book tells us that whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. There is madness in the air, and this madness is a problem that we all have to face. But there's one thing we can remember, and we should remember, and should work with it in every way that we can. Namely, that our own individual security is in our own hands. We cannot be destroyed by temptation unless we are tempted. We cannot get into trouble unless we set the causes of trouble in motion in our own lives. We cannot be completely disillusioned unless we have done things that were not very right and they have disappointed us. The individual is not in any real emergency as long as he stays sober, thinks straight, and does all that he can to deepen his understanding of the official and natural principles of life. We live in a world that can take care of us beautifully. We live on a planet that has much to bestow. But if we go to work gradually and relentlessly to destroy our own resources, whether they be social, geographical, or psychological, if we keep on destroying them, wasting them, perverting them, we can get this old planet, which is such a willing and wonderful servant, into a very desperate situation. We have to begin to take some kind of serious thought on the problems that confront us. A new generation growing up today is really in serious trouble. It is growing up in a world that has lost the name of conduct and tradition. It is no longer controlled by anything except personal ambitions, dissatisfactions, and various forms of anarchy. The individual growing up has much to tell us that we should listen to. First of all, somewhere along the line, he may turn and say, if I had had a different education, I might have done better. With an entirely inadequate schooling, I am thrown into chaos. Instead of being given the skills within self to estimate values and refrain from unfortunate involvements, the young person is in trouble. He is in trouble because of example. The older generation is not developing his integrities. Those situations which he finds in life are compromised on every hand for profit. He finds himself in a world of ulterior motives. And if there is any basic integrity in him, he's pretty well sickened by the whole situation. He also discovers that all the institutions to which he might turn for guidance and integrities have themselves been more or less discredited. We find that the average institution does not have any moral program to protect those who belong to it, work for it, or cooperate with it. There is a world, therefore, in which young people are at a serious disadvantage. Their personal lives are inadequate. Many of them are from broken homes. A great many of them have a bad hereditary background. And they have had practically no inducement to unfold the latent potentials of themselves. Many of them are not even aware that the mind is for anything except for the gratification of appetites. With this type of a world to live in, it is quite understandable why an escape mechanism suddenly becomes highly desirable to their thinking. An escape mechanism simply based upon the idea of have fun this minute. Do what you want to right now. If you want to feel 10 feet tall right now, do so. If you want to rise above all the problems of society, hypnotize yourself into the sense of your own greatness. This is accomplished in various ways through drug abuses. It causes the individual to temporarily lose sight of his own integrities. They are already submerged where he can hardly find them, but he makes certain that he has a surface life which will last a few years. How a generation of people growing up in a land with the privileges and opportunities that we have here can go consciously and intelligently into the gentle process of destroying themselves, knowing by evidence, proof beyond doubt, that as a result of drug addiction, they are going to ruin their own lives in a few years and will probably die unpleasantly. If this doesn't mean anything, then it would seem to imply that to many of these young people, death by drug addiction is better than life without it. This is an indictment of civilization. And it is an indictment of a pattern with which we hope to build a future. We hope to be able to prove that our way of life, a way of freedom, democracy, and cooperation, can lead the rest of the world somewhere. But with the present pattern, we have lost our own footings almost completely. We are not in a position to lead anyone anywhere. Our religious institutions, which might have considerable influence in this matter, are more or less eliminated by the modern materialistic youth, which is not much concerned with these matters until misery sets in, and then it is usually too late. Our education is failing. The distribution of values is failing. The power to make a decent living by effort and ethics, this is failing. And the individual finds himself in a world which is not worth living in as far as values are concerned. He finds himself in a very difficult and miserable condition. When we take this person to a psychiatrist and get him under psychiatric care, it is necessary, if possible, to gradually work him through a whole mass of complexes and a great number of fixations of his own mind, including delusions, work him through again to a sense of normalcy. In some mysterious way, the Aegean stable has to be cleansed. We have to give the mind, the brain itself, a house cleaning to get rid of the false opinions, the desperate attitudes, the disillusioned convictions of most people today. So the psychiatrist settles down to an extensive procedure, which may or may not be successful, but will certainly be expensive. Instead of that, what is happening? We are opening, by means of narcotics, this whole background of psychological mayhem within the individual by a reduction of conscious control of attitudes. Under the influence of drugs, the door opens, and every misery, every adversity, every pressure, every frustration comes out with a torrent of pressures behind it. And these pressures coming out without anything to control them lead to excesses from which very few young people can survive. Now, the problem of the entire process is what happens? What happens in connection with, for instance, cocaine? How does it affect? The best way we can approach it at the moment is to recognize that this effect is largely the result of magnetic fields and their interplays. If we had the instruments by which we could make the necessary adjustments, and maybe we will have some of them, we will discover that narcotics, and like all other plant or mineral products, are alive. They have vibratory rates. They have their own magnetic fields. They are not simply what you can see and taste. Behind everything that we know is a vibratory rate. And this vibratory rate is the problem with which we are most concerned. We know also that in the human body, there are various polarities over which through which nature has been able to control the conduct. The human mind and the emotional focuses are locked behind a pattern of laws and are filtered through the mind as a result of experience, morality, ethics, conviction, education, opportunity, racial and national traditions. The mind is a guardian of the subconscious. The mind helps the individual to prevent the pressures from within from going out and destroying him, or the pressures on the outside getting in and destroying him. The mind is a kind of coordinating filter by means of which everything is reduced to usable levels of process. Excesses of one kind or another do not occur unless there is an abuse or misuse of energy. Now, the center of most of our problem in this particular case will probably be the endocrine system. We will define probably that the pineal gland is the center by which moderation and coordination is possible in the physical body. It is a controlling factor, not only physically, but metaphysically. The pineal gland is a structure by means of which the magnetic fields of the whole body are regulated. Every organ has an integration in itself. The stomach is an entity. The ancients realized this. We don't. We know, however, that if we treat the stomach badly enough, it is going to come back at us. It is not going to accept abuse without resistance. If, however, we pay no attention to a reasonable request for reformation, then the various organs and glands and so forth settle down to suffer, deteriorate, and finally lose control of the functions which they are supposed to regulate. It seems very likely at the present time that the individual using certain narcotic drugs is breaking down the protective structure between the inside and the outside of himself. He is passing gradually from a real and existing thing into a kind of dream world, mostly nightmares. He finds himself in a vista or a rate of vibration which normally he is protected against. It is this same rate around which nearly all the traditions of magic were built. It is this mysterious rate of energy that is the controlling factor in determining right and wrong in conduct. It is also a door leading into the invisible realms, which are populated also by rates of energy, rates of vibration, which are received into the human consciousness very often as beings or entities. Here we have, therefore, a person who is not able to adjust in this world, suddenly being confronted with a series of phantoms. Phantoms which are phantasms of his own brain miscalculations. The door leading in to the subconscious being opened, a mass of miseries come out. One simple example I remember that came into my particular observation was a young man who had a very interesting but tragic life. He belonged to a minority racial group, and from birth and childhood had felt the oppression of the popular opinion against the people with whom he was related. He was hurt, damaged, antagonized, frustrated, and finally became actively rebellious. With the power of economic need and with the profession for which he had been educated, he was able to keep this particular problem rather under control. He worked out some of it through dream symbolism. He worked out some of it through psychological counseling. And he worked out some more of it by being busy doing things that took his energies and gave him a certain sense of fulfillment. Somewhere along the line, this individual suddenly develops an addiction to alcohol, which is, of course, not by any means as excessive, usually, as some other addictions. But within 3 months, this man was destroyed. The moment he lost the control of his own conscious mind, every misery, every persecution, every bit of misfortune that went back for generations in his family surged out, and he actually committed crime. He would never have committed crime had the pressure within himself not been so intense and the defenses against it had been gradually removed by alcohol. Therefore, any individual who is not happy in a normal state will be more unhappy under the addiction of any form of stimulant which breaks down the defenses of the conscious character of the person. Nearly everyone is born with a dual nature. He is born with the instrument by which he can adjust to society and by which he gradually converts himself to a reasonable way of life. In order to accomplish this, however, you have hereditary factors. You also have early environmental conditionings, and you have the larger environment of social existence. Where the person grows up in a comparatively secure atmosphere, he has not too much danger of any serious drug habit. But where he has not had any fixation of character, he's had no structural support, the situation gets worse and worse. We have passed through in the last century, in the present century, we have passed through two world wars, great depressions, and we're in the midst of complete planetary upheaval. This should be the great challenge. To meet this, every individual should be using the very best mental equipment that he has. He should be thinking seriously on the ways in which he can think straight in a crooked situation, how he can survive all of these difficulties simply because he has resources within himself that are stronger than the pressures on the outside. Today, the average young person does not have these resources, and older persons in various walks of life also lack these resources. It is not today very good or easy to find the type of life that would contribute to security. If we go into, for instance, our entertainment world, we find that the entire programs of television, stage, theater,
all these elements are completely corrupted. They are broken down into the gratification of the very miseries with which we are trying to protect ourselves against. We are in the face of a series of phantoms, illusions, dream images, imaginary stories, all kinds of psychological pressures that exist for only one reason, namely to make money. We are supposed to have these because a larger audience watches them. And a larger audience watches them because more people are sick than are well. Therefore, the individual who is in the midst of a frustrational mess himself can identify with misery, but cannot identify with growth, progress, and harmony. Actually, the entire situation is closing in because of the incredible stupidity of people. It is due to the fact that with all our thinking and with all our planning, our great dream in life is to live in a peaceful world, happy and well-adjusted, without sacrificing any ambition, any selfishness, or any misuse of energy or waste of time. We are supposed to be able to perfect the world as it is, keeping all of the factors that we enjoy as amusement or for profit, and at the same time live noble and exalted careers. It just cannot be done. And we are going to face it more and more as time goes on. Now, the factor of karma plays an important part also in this situation. Karma is individual, and it is also collective. Karma can be a long-range procedure in which the individual brings with him into embodiment the debts unpaid in time past. It also can lead into the future, so that present action may have its ultimate conclusion far beyond the present day. Now, we may assume, and most people must assume, that the karma which we have brought with us into life is a mixed blessing. This doesn't mean that none of it is good. There are many wonderful things that we bring with us. In fact, nearly everyone is born with an idealism of some kind. He is not born without it, but it is taken away from him in his formative growth years. He comes into this world to enjoy the wonders of life. As a small child, he sees around him only wonders and mysteries. But if the family is close, his childhood is happy. But the average family is not close, and this is partly due to economic situation, in which the child's misery results from the necessity of the parents to take care of the economic conditions. On the other hand, this is also often abused, in which the parents take on extravagances and personal pleasures beyond their means, and then blame that for the fact that they cannot take care of their families. So into this world, the individual comes with karma. But he nearly always comes with a great deal of potential. One of the terrible tragedies of the modern world is that most persons are born and die without releasing the internal potential with which they were supposed to build a life. Instead of releasing potential, they are simply smothered by outside pressures. Actually, society is a little better than we think it is. There are a great many very good people. There are a great many good homes. There are a great number of honest persons, and still many more who would be honest if they knew how to accomplish this. Therefore, we have with us a strong potential. We have great possibilities, but we also have the unfinished business of our own lives. The moment the individual reaches 5 or 10 years of age, character is clearly indicated. People have their own individual ways of life. These ways may or may not resemble the ways of their parents in any way. They come with talents, abilities, concepts, attitudes, dispositions. These must be trained, developed, organized, and worked with. but no one seems to have the time to do it. And by the time they get around to it, because the child has become a delinquent, it is too late to accomplish the necessary corrections. But the use of what we bring into life is tremendously important. It is quite obvious, I think, that most persons coming into life do not primarily desire to be rich or famous. The rich-fame complex comes a little later when it becomes obvious to them that wealth and distinction bring with them certain advantages, certain fulfillments otherwise difficult. But in most cases, the greater the wealth, the less the likelihood of the inner life being developed or sustained. Because as wealth increases, interests change from the improvement of character to the accumulation of possessions. But actually, each individual is a potential helper in the perfection of civilization. Every good thing that the world has today came from within some human being who brought it forth as music, as art, as literature, as drama, as history, all kinds of wonderful developments, discoveries, and experiments have been carried on by human beings, many of them for the advancement and benefit of society. Therefore, each person has something to give. But if he can't give it, and it is locked within himself, a certain tension develops, a stress, a frustration. The individual who has always wanted, as long as he can remember back, has always wanted to go to sea in a ship, finds himself locked in a broker's office. An individual whom nature has intended to be an artist ends up as a doctor because there's more money in it. Little by little, the physical advantages take shape against natural integrities and natural interests. The individual, not being able to do what he wants to do, sits uneasily in his body for the rest of his life. He is never quite adjusted because he has never fulfilled himself and has substituted false fulfillments for the impulses and instincts that he brought with him. Not being truly adjusted to the profession he may accept, he will not be a great success even in that. And not being a success in anything, he finds it becomes a great fatiguing factor. Out of this comes a common occurrence which we all have a tendency to notice, and that is the desperate interest with which we look forward to retirement. We believe that when retirement comes, we can get out of the job we never wanted to be in. But how could we help ourselves with children to educate, with parents to protect, with grandchildren to bless, and all kinds of responsibilities of government, taxation, and economic stress. Therefore, at 65, we assume that we are going to have release. Another way in which we get the assumption is when we get the first million. If we get the first million, we're sure then we can live as we want to. And then the pressures start and are much worse than they were before. So that nothing seems to work out. The individual who doesn't do what he wants to do is in trouble. The individual who sacrifices his ideals for profit is in trouble. And both look forward to retirement. So they retire at 65 so they can live their own lives. And what have they got? Nothing. They have no life. Certainly they don't want to go on with the professions that they didn't like while they were working with them. They have no other vital interests, so they settle down to the quiet contemplation of impossible television. Or they go someplace and try to do a little charity work as a sort of soul repentance for a life of self-centeredness. Many of these people are good people, but again, the ability to release from within has been destroyed. Now, when you start releasing from within, however, you do run against problems. You run against the fact that these releases must be natural, gentle, and suitable to our need. We cannot afford to have karma dumped on us too fast either, because we may not be able to carry it. Karma consists primarily of unfinished business. And for the average human being, unfinished business is character building. It is the process of growing. And this is something that is not finished, and we may not even maintain during the one lifetime that we are here now. So therefore, when this kind of situation develops, we find that it is best to have this karma move in on us with a certain amount of pattern, which we can react to, by which we can learn something, by which we can accept a lesson as being valuable to us. But if under tremendous mental or emotional pressure, a karmic load is discharged too rapidly, the individual simply becomes sick. And the sickness is usually in the form of some kind of mental emotional activism, an antisocial reaction, a reaction of destruction, pressure, and tension. Everyone is capable of a bad disposition, but a great many people have learned not to have it because they've done something about it. Now, if we take a person who has a bad so-called daily existence, and we take this person into retirement, we're going to find that this bad disposition begins to move and work. Then we will find the lack of proper activity, mental and emotional, results in what might be termed senility. Where there's nothing inside, the individual simply weakens. Where there is something inside that is bad, the older person becomes more difficult. Where if there is something inside that is good and the mind is no longer interfering, then the individual is a pleasant in person and may have a rather quiet, enjoyable old age. All these things relate to the development and release of the psychic potential of the person. Actually, therefore, we have to begin to recognize that the individual who goes out and gets drunk for the first time is telling us a story of a pattern, a fulfillment sought in the wrong way, an inability to cope with self, and a desperate effort to escape self, to forget that we exist, to pass finally into a kind of a genteel coma. But on the way to this coma, something happens. The individual, partly intoxicated, may become violent, may attack his family, may become a criminal, may do all kinds of disreputable things which he would never do if he was sober. And that release of the so-called negative side of life, when the pressure of the public opinion is removed, the half-drunk person is very much likely to be similar in many ways to the individual under narcotics. The half-intoxicated person is unable to control his own drinking and has a series of delusions, probably including delirium tremens. And the drug addict also passes through all kinds of moods, some of them over-exhilarated, some of them definitely destructive. The individual having lost control of himself